We found that a few could help improve some specific symptoms of constipation, such as kiwi fruits, prunes, rye bread, and also water high in mineral content. And when we look into the supplements, we confirmed that psyllium supplements tend to be beneficial for improving symptoms of constipation. Also, a specific probiotic supplement, specific species and strains, and also food supplements such as magnesium oxide supplements were found to be beneficial across several symptoms.
Welcome to the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from the International Scientific Association for Probiotics and Prebiotics, a non-profit scientific organization also known as ISAP. I'm Marla Cunningham, ISAP's Executive Director. This episode is part of our podcast series exploring the latest evidence on biotics and gastrointestinal applications. In this series, we speak with experts about some of the latest published reviews that cover evidence on the safety and efficacy of probiotics and prebiotics for clinically relevant gastrointestinal symptoms and outcomes.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of the ISAP Science, Microbes and Health podcast. Today, we're delighted to be joined by Dr. Irini Dimity, who's an Associate Professor of Nutritional Sciences at King's College in London. Welcome, Irini.
Hello.
So Irini is a registered dietitian and a nutritionist since 2011, after completing a BSc in Nutrition and Dietetics and an MSc in Clinical and Public Health Nutrition. This was followed by the completion of a PhD from King's College London, where she investigated the effectiveness of probiotics in individuals with chronic constipation. She has since gone on to do research in a number of areas, including fiber, prebiotics, probiotics, plant foods, and plant-based diets in gut function and dysfunction. She was awarded the 2023 Cuthbertson Medal by the Nutrition Society and the 2022 ISAP, Glenn Gibson Early Career Research Prize for her research on the effect of diet. She has also received the 2021 Rising Star and 2020 Elizabeth Washington Awards by the British Dietetic Association. Clearly a very accomplished young person. So, Irini, welcome. Tell us what you're doing right now.
So I continue. I am based at King's College London. I work a lot on diet and nutritional interventions and investigate them in clinical trials, human clinical trials, and on their effects in gut function. At the moment, there's a few projects going on. I do a lot on plant foods and plant-based diets and their impact on the gut microbiome. So I'm planning a large RCT to finally answer the question whether diversity matters when we talk about plant foods and gut health, along with some side projects on how the gut microbiota can be amended through the diet and influence perhaps the gut-brain axis, but also immune health.
So I'm very interested to see what you're working on at the moment in relation to constipation, because I think it's a very much ignored area in GI disease. And I'm always impressed when I see patients by how distressed they can become by constipation. So give us kind of your general overview on where you feel the microbiome might play a role in the pathogenesis of constipation, and then we can move on to talk about treatments.
Yes, first of all, to say that I agree chronic constipation is a major concern for patients that suffer from that with a lot of debilitating symptoms. And yes, the gut microbiome is implicated in the pathophysiology of chronic constipation. There's a lot of case control studies that show that the gut microbiome is different in people that have constipation compared to people that don't. And there's even been some links between the gut microbiome and certain symptoms of constipation. But of course, it's that usual problem that we have in this area where we don't know if this is a cause of constipation or this is a result of the impact that constipation may have on many different aspects, diet, and also other functions and metabolic functions in the body that may impact the microbiome.
Irini, thanks for being with us today, and thanks for your amazing work you have done so far. Do you think, and this may be a question also for Eamon, that we are not, in general, feeding enough our microbes?
Well, I don't know if I can say whether we feed them enough or not. What I can say is that a primary dietary factor that we know plays a significant impact on the gut microbiome, fiber. We know that when we look at epidemiological studies, the amount of fiber that the general population consumes is generally a lot lower than the national recommendations. So for example, if we look at the UK, where I am based, the latest data show that the general population consumes in average 16 grams per day of fiber, when the national recommendations are that we should be eating 30 grams per day to maintain overall health, including gut health. So we definitely could be doing more in a population level to provide the substrates that we know are beneficial for the microbiome.
So you've been part of the involved in the recent UK guidelines on management of constipation with diet and with a variety of other agents. So could you summarize to us what your recommendations are as a dietitian for the management of constipation?
Yeah, so in this project, so these are the first ever diet-focused guidelines for the management of chronic constipation. And what we wanted to do is look at the literature and find every single evidence from RCTs that have assessed the impact of diet, including supplements, foods, drinks, and whole diets in chronic constipation. And it was great to see that there has been some research, there was evidence out there to be able to provide and devise those recommendations. If we look at a food and drink level before we go into supplements, we found that a few could help improve some specific symptoms of constipation, such as kiwi fruits, prunes, rye bread, and also a water high mineral content. And when we look into the supplements, we confirmed that psyllium supplements tend to be beneficial for improving symptoms of constipation. Also, a specific probiotic supplement, specific species and strains, and also food supplements such as magnesium oxide supplements were found to be beneficial across several symptoms.
When you take a look, it's an amazing amount of work you perform. You did 4 meta-analyses before doing that. Can you tell us what was the process? How did you came with this guideline? What is the how long did it take to make all this work?
Yes, it was a much bigger amount of work than I expected originally, but that is to be expected given that we wanted to be very comprehensive and thorough. So just to give you a bit of an idea why I did that was because I remember back in 2017, 18, really looking at the current guidelines at the time that were clinical guidelines and trying to understand what the evidence or the recommendations were around diet. And the amount of dietary recommendations was just very, very low, very small. And they were always focused on specific aspects and more vague aspects like a high fiber diet or adequate fluid intake. And I just knew there was more evidence out there. So that's why I decided to do this project. And I was very lucky that the British Dietetic Association funded this. And because I wanted to make sure that we identify every single study, intervention study that has been previously performed and we don't miss anything, we had to do thorough systematic reviews and meta-analysis. And because of the scale of this, looking at, you know, every single food, drink, whole diet and supplement, we did 4 different systematic reviews and meta-analyses.
Each meta-analysis focusing in something in particular?
Exactly, just because of the volume.
Amount.
So the first one was on fiber and prebiotics. The second one was on probiotic and symbiotics. The third one was on food supplements, and the fourth one was on foods, drinks, and whole diets.
And then you apply the GRADE system and Adelphi consultation.
Absolutely.
The work this didn't stop there. It was just the beginning, the systematic.
Yes, you're right. We did a thorough risk of bias assessment, and then we applied the GRADE approach to assess the level of evidence and the strength of recommendation. And then after that, we also had to do the Delphi consensus process, which was a multi-stage process until we managed to get consensus among the guideline steering committee. And only after an appropriate, above 85% of agreement level was met, then statements were finalized and the guidelines were written. And overall, when we look back, we found 75 RCTs on foods, drinks, whole diets, and supplements that were used to develop 59 dietary recommendations.
Look, I'm looking at your summary table, which is extremely helpful, as you said. And what is striking is how few of these various interventions that you studied actually were.
Yes. And you know, when we were thinking about that table that you're looking at, it's the first figure of the guidelines. We were thinking, okay, should we only highlight the ones that work and only the symptoms that they work for? Or and completely leave out the ones that don't work? Or should we include everything? And we had some deliberations about it, and we ended up deciding that we actually show everything, because I think it's very important that we stay informed, not just about what works or what doesn't work, but also what may make some symptoms worse at the same time. So because some interventions, we know that they may improve some symptoms of constipation, but make bloating worse.
Absolutely. So looking through the chart there, a couple of things strike me. First of all, there seems to be no evidence for whole diets.
This was very surprising and unexpected to us as well, given that a high fiber diet, where diet comes from any source of food or drink, is the most commonly recommended dietary strategy for chronic constipation. Is eat more fiber if we look around the international guidelines. But actually, when we look at the evidence, we only found one RCT, and that did not provide enough evidence to support any claim. Now, I want to make sure that the message here is very clear. We're not saying that people shouldn't have a diet high in fiber. We know that that is very beneficial for overall health and for gut health and the gut microbiome. But when it comes to chronic constipation, we just do not have sufficient evidence to support.
It's just a lack of data, basically.
Yes, exactly. It's a lack. And maybe in the future, well, hopefully in the future, we're working towards that, we will have that evidence. And that may show that they do work or not. But at the moment, when we talk about evidence-based practice, we just lack that evidence for high-fiber diet.
So for the moment, would you say that the recommendation would be take a supplement of fiber, that with the fiber in diet is not enough? Is that the message?
Not necessarily, because we were able to find that there are specific foods that are helpful with constipation and they are high in fiber themselves. So kiwi fruits, prunes, rye bread as well. Probably their key mechanism of action is the fiber they contain. So there are ways to supplement your diet through, in terms of fiber through foods as well. But yes, if that is not enough and we want to find other ways to improve constipation or increase fiber to improve constipation, psyllium supplements have been shown to also considerably improve, significantly improve symptoms.
One other thing that strikes me is that over the time scale of all of these studies, and quite a few of these studies are old, as you know very well.
Yeah.
The definition of constipation has changed.
Yes.
And we've gone from a definition which relied purely on frequency to one which includes a whole lot of other symptoms like straining, incomplete evacuation, use of manual maneuvers, et cetera, et cetera. And again, looking at the table, most of the studies focused on stool frequency and on stool consistency. They did not really evaluate the other studies. I think you would acknowledge that's a limitation of the data.
Yeah, I completely agree. And in terms of your first point, so there's two points that I want to make here, and I'm just going to say them now so I don't forget the second one. The first one is about the diagnosis, and the second one is about the focus on stool output. With the diagnosis, you're right, it has changed and moved in times significantly. And we had a lot of discussions as well about, okay, which population group are we focusing on? Should we only focus on studies with using the ROM criteria or broaden that up? And because these are clinical guidelines, we want them to be used in clinic and be applicable to any patient with chronic idiopathic constipation that may appear in front of us and we have to give advice. We approach this from a very practical way. So we included constipation that is defined through diagnostic criteria, like ROM criteria. We also included constipation based on how the clinician would diagnose it. So a clinician-based or author-based diagnosis based on what they believe and their assessment. Also self-reported constipation, because we just see people coming to us and say, I think I have constipation. I believe I have constipation. I will need to treat that, even if they don't strictly meet the criteria for a diagnosis. So we made sure we capture and we have a representative sample of what we see in clinical practice. Now, in terms of your second point and stool output, you're absolutely right. Most of the studies focus on stool output and rarely on all the other symptoms that have been reported in constipation. I think part of that is because also there's that common perception that one of the most important outcomes to assess is complete spontaneous bowel movements in chronic constipation. It's interesting that actually we did a large trial over a few years in over 2,000 people of the general population, and actually frequency of bowel movements is not rated as a very important symptom for patients themselves. They rate other symptoms such as straining or a sense of incomplete evacuation as more important. So maybe that's clear that we need to shift that also and reflect that in clinical trials. And not it's not that we shouldn't be assessing stool output, because that's absolutely crucial as well. But it's more that moving forward, we have to reflect what is important to patients as well.
And that's been shown in many studies, as you know, around the world. Mm-hmm. And we have to talk about probiotics.
I had a question for that. Let me read you exactly what you put here in one of the boxes. You says clinicians may support patients who wish to try probiotics and advise them to try a probiotic brand of their choice. Is that they can choose any probiotics? Because I would expect that you know a specific strain, but any of their choice. What would you say?
So when we made the statements, we tried to make them species and strain specific. So we have shown and we've made claims that are very specific on the type of probiotics. So for example, we did show, and it is included in the table, that Bacillus coagulans unique IS2 significantly improves defecation pain and abdominal pain. So when there is evidence that specific species or strains improve symptoms, that the symptoms of interest, then obviously we have to go with this. But it's that ambiguity in the evidence so far that we don't know and which exact strains are the most effective, at which dose, at which duration, just because we lack also reproducibility of those trials to be able to make those confident conclusions. And for that reason, because we know that clinicians are faced very often with that question of probiotics in clinical practice, and people want to use them. They see them in adverts. We know that adverts is the main source of information for patients' use of probiotics. We showed that in the trial, in the survey I mentioned earlier. They come to clinic and they ask for it. So we said that if patients do want to try them, and we cannot provide one of those specific strains that have been shown and are in the table for whatever reason, either because they don't improve the particular symptom that they want to see improving, or because it's not available in the market, which is another big issue.
That's an issue around the world.
It doesn't mean that just because something was studied is available wherever they are based at. We just said you can support if you want the use. We didn't show any harm or any side effects, but because there's no evidence to suggest any more information specific, then that can be up to their choice.
I notice also that in your summary, you do not include any prebiotic data, which was surprising. Was that just because there wasn't any data?
Yeah, so in the systematic review and meta-analysis for fiber, we did categorize the different fibers based on whether there were prebiotics or non-prebiotics. And there were quite a few prebiotic trials that were particularly, if I remember that right, on inulin and galactoligosaccharides. And when we did sensitivity analysis based on whether prebiotics grouped together were effective or not, in general, we did not find a significant improvement for the prebiotics that were assessed at the dose that were assessed, at the duration that they were assessed. Although with inulin type fructans, we did find an improvement in stool consistency. And that was specific for inulin, not prebiotics overall.
And in there, it just had an effect on stool consistency, not on any of the other parameters.
Exactly.
Now, one of the things that to somebody at my age was shocking, and when I say somebody at my age, when I was a trainee gastroenterologist, the first line treatment for irritable bowel syndrome, for constipation, was coarse Miller's bran, wheat bran. And from your chart, I see that you didn't find any data to support that. You're not saying that it didn't work, but there's just no data, which really surprised me.
yes, we did not find data in this specific population that were placebo-controlled. The trials were placebo-controlled to be able to make any recommendation.
And of course, that's very interesting because, of course, it's not, people don't tolerate it very well. It's like eating sawdust. And that's why I think supplements like psyllium have become so popular in contrast. So, Gabriel, you had a question.
Yes. What would you say are the main contribution of this work compared to what was known before? Or is this work changing something that people knew or had an idea that people should have to reconsider?
Yes, there were a few things that were new with these guidelines. We've touched already on some. So, for example, the high fiber concept. In these guidelines, we don't make any recommendations about high fiber because we did not find evidence, sufficient evidence to support such recommendations. Again, this is about constipation specifically, not general health. The second one is that we found evidence and we made recommendations for dietary strategies that have never been included in previous international guidelines. For example, kiwi fruits, high mineral content water, and magnesium oxide supplements have been mentioned, I think, was it in the American ones, but only in one other guideline previously. So again, we were able to show a consistent effect, and therefore they definitely have a place in clinical guidelines. And yes, and I think the other way around, that other recommendations that are being made by guidelines around the world, we found not enough evidence. And it wasn't just high fiber diets. I don't know if that happens in other countries in the world, but in the UK, for example, we've been suggesting linseeds and oats for constipation. We did not find sufficient evidence for that. So we haven't made recommendations for that either.
So, getting back to the microbiome, which is where we started, of these various interventions, how many of them have evidence that they may operate through changing the microbiome?
To answer this with confidence, I would need for the clinical trial to have also measured microbiome outcomes, to have this as an outcome. And I think it's very rarely that I can think of that any of these did. So most of the time, they focus on clinical outcomes and symptoms, or perhaps gut transit time. There were a few that focused on gut transit time as well, including probiotics. That was an outcome that was assessed for probiotics. Now, thinking about the mechanism through which foods, drinks, and supplements may affect the gut microbiome, fiber is the key one. Is a key one, right? And quite a few of these interventions are high in fiber. Kiwi fruits, prunes. Actually, in fact, prunes have evidence that they affect the gut microbiome. We do have some evidence on that. I think it's the Liver et al. Paper. I don't remember exactly the date. That showed that some bacteria are in the microbiome are significantly different compared to the control. Same, I suspect that was a mechanism of action with the rye bread as well, especially considering that they worsened. The rye bread worsened some symptoms, which I suspect it's due to fermentation of the fiber. So I think I would believe that a lot of the mechanistic background involves the microbiome. But again, ideally, we would need these as a secondary outcome or a primary outcome for a lot of these trials, maybe in the future.
Edine, in a previous work, 2019, I think, in published Nutrients, you explore also the use of fermented food for different health outcomes. But I remember that seen in a table, three studies with kefir, with water kefir and constipation. Is there any recommendation for these fermented foods? Do they have any role?
We did not include any recommendations for kefir. And the reason is because these specific studies were non-randomized controlled intervention trials. And therefore, they wouldn't be eligible to be part of the systematic reviews and the development of the guidelines. We wanted to only focus on trials, on RCT trials. But if we look at those three studies, you're right. There is some preliminary data, at least, to suggest that there is some indication that could help with constipation, but we have to follow this up with proper RCTs, high quality ones. And again, it's the same issue with kefir, that it's not just about constipation, it's about any kefir and any fermented food. It's about knowing the exact composition of the fermented food, in this case, kefir, in terms of the probiotics and also the metabolic, the
And we know this the composition changes from one kefir to the other, and it changes a long time. It's very difficult to manage this kind of fermented foods.
Yes, and I can imagine in the future, should there be evidence for multiple RCTs or multiple kefir products, how do you make that recommendation?
Yeah.
To be specific to what has been shown, but you don't know whether that's what's on the market, and you know that whatever is on the market will probably be different. So it will be interesting to see in the future how that would be handled if a benefit was shown.
No, and before we finish, because we're getting close to the end, I'd like you to tell us what you're working on at the moment and what you hope to work on in the near future. What are the areas that you're really passionate about?
So I'm really passionate about investigating the role of diet and nutrition in gut health. This is my research, my whole program, and it's about doing randomized controlled trials to provide definite answers on the role of diet. I do strongly believe that diet plays a very important role, not just on the gut microbiome, but also in gut health overall and health overall. And I just wish to provide more evidence to establish further treatments. I do want to do more work on constipation. So as part of the guidelines, we also made 12 research recommendations where we lack evidence and we need more answers. So part of my program right now is to hopefully provide and develop the trials and provide those answers. But in general, I'm focusing on the effect on how we can optimize gut health through the gut microbiome, even in healthy people. So more from the preventative side. So like I mentioned earlier in the beginning, I'm currently planning and about to start a large RCT on the effect of plant food diversity on the gut microbiome.
What I would like you to, just to be finished, to talk about is the whole issue of the challenge of doing dietary studies, which are very difficult.
Yes, it is very difficult. And I think that's probably why we also lack a lot of robust data when it comes to dietary studies. If we look through the PICOS criteria, for example, there are challenges in every single part of the PICOS. So if we look at participants, and for example, we're doing a probiotic trial, we have to consider about how we select the appropriate population that will be suitable. What happens with their background diet? What if they consume probiotics through their diet, such as fermented foods? How do we select the appropriate population? Same with the control. What is an appropriate control to kefir or to kiwi fruits, which the guidelines were focused? How do you do a blinded trial of a food product where participants can see what they are consuming? You cannot mask kefir or a kiwi fruit. So how do you make an appropriately controlled trial that indeed answers the research question definitively? It's very challenging, but it is possible. And that is what we specialize on in nutrition research, is about designing trials that indeed answer the research question and selecting the appropriate outcomes as well. And when it comes to the outcomes, dietary analysis is absolutely essential in nutrition and dietary trials. Because when we change one thing through diet, we can change a lot of other things at the same time. So if we, for example, again, have a kefir intervention or a kiwi fruit intervention, if they have that, what does that replace from their diet?
Exactly.
And what is that impact on their overall nutrient intake? And does that confound or not the outcome of interest? So how do we control for that is absolutely essential, and also to assess it and take it into account when analyzing and interpreting the data. So dietary analysis is very, very important. It is very challenging, but it is possible, and we have to commit to doing more and better nutrition studies.
Eleni, where can people find more from your work? Social media, any web page?
Yes, I'm on LinkedIn at the moment. Eleni Dimidi is my full name. That's usually where I post most of my work and the trainings and the presentations that I may give. I usually provide summaries. So I think at the moment that's probably the best way.
Fantastic.
Well, thank you very much, Eleni. This has been a great conversation, and we really enjoyed talking to you. And I wish you the very best with your work It is challenging, but I think if anybody's going to do this properly, you're going to.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Science, Microbes and Health podcast from ISAP. If you've been enjoying the show, please follow and rate our podcast to help support our continued work. You can also send us your feedback, questions or topic suggestions by emailing info@isapscience.org and check the show notes for links and further information on this topic.